reverse the results of Indy's 7 years of neglect. Vote for all Justice and Unity candidates. Learn more at justiceunity.org or 212-591-2111.
Hello, Cabal. I'm Frank Lefevre, one of the four directors elected to represent BAI on the Pacifica National Board last January, but never allowed into its meetings. Please go online to pacificainexile.com for updates on the continuing threats to BAI. For years, I have done what I can do to advertise BAI, a task that management shirks. In this and other areas, half of the current LSB seems strangely protective of management.
Hi, I'm Ken Laufer, the secretary of the LSB, and I'm running for re-election to ensure that WBAI is never sold. The people we send to the Pacifica National Board have power, and a bunch of them on the PNB elected a chief financial officer who has called for plans to liquidate WBAI. To make sure that this never happens, please vote for Frank Lefevre, that's an easy name to remember, Jim Sagerton, Ken Laufer, Carl Macauer, Mike Ocella, and Rebecca Nagele. New York City without a progressive radio station? I'm Ken Laufer, and I won't allow for that. And yes, we're currently preventing meetings because the Justice and Unity members insist on seating someone illegally.
For more information on the election, visit elections.pacifica.org.
We'll be right back. And you're listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis, and I'm in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
And also joining us is
Matt Mazza.
Say that again.
Matt Mazza.
All right. And we are going to have a lovely show for you today. We're going to play another piece of music, a great piece of music by Gregory Porter, and then we'll be back. And Paulette has done a wonderful interview for us. And when we come back, we'll introduce the interview. And let's get started.
Hello, this is Gregory Porter, and this is Take Me to the Alley, One Mic, One Take. Preparation for the king, and they line the sidewalks with every sort of shiny thing, but they will be surprised. Take me to the alley. Take me to the afflicted one. Take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. Let them hear me say, I am your friend. Come to my table. Rest here in my garden. You will have a pardon.
Take me to the alley. Take me to the afflicted ones. Take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. Let them hear me say, oh, I am your friend. Come to my table. Rest here in my garden. You will have a part. One, take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. Let them hear me say, I am your friend. Come to my table. Rest here in my garden. You will have a pardon. You will have a pardon. Rest here. Lonely one, hungry one, tired one, rest here in my garden. Whoa, whoa.
And that was Gregory Porter, Take Me to the Alley. I heard that Paulette and I actually were at a concert and at Prospect Park, and he was doing a concert there. And I heard it for the first time and fell in love with that song. Absolutely fell in love with it. So thank you for bringing it in, Paulette.
You're most welcome.
And I want you to stay tuned in another 25 minutes. Matt will be continuing his reading of Ishmael, and I'm intrigued to see what comes up next. But we're going to hear an interview that Paulette Spencer did for us. And is it introduced in the cut, or do you want to say something ahead of time?
It's introduced in the cut, but as a brief intro, the interview is based on current politics in Brazil, where the president, Dilma Rousseff, is going through quite a difficult time with a Brazilian Senate that wants to get rid of her. And the interview's discussion of what led up to the current situation.
All right, here we go. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. My name is Paulette Spencer, and we are honored to discuss today the goings-on right now with the Brazilian government concerning President Dilma Rousseff and the efforts that are being made to oust her from her position. As we speak, the Olympics are being held, but in the background, decisions are being made by the Senate as to whether or not Ms. Rousseff will be in position as president by the end of the month. And we are honored today to have with us Ms. Maria Luisa Mendonca. Ms. Mendonca is director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights. She is also a professor in the International Relations Department at the University of Rio de Janeiro and the editor of the book Human Rights in Brazil. Thank you, Ms. Mendonca, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to sort of give the audience a snapshot of the country of Brazil. It is one of the largest economies in the world, and it apparently has, according to the 2015 data, roughly 200 million inhabitants, about half of whom identify as people of African descent. And for the past 12 years has been run under the approach to economics that really encompasses social development as a focus for bringing the country out of poverty, which it has suffered from, and increasing the numbers of residents in the middle class and lifting people out of extreme poverty through social programs. And today we're going to discuss some of what has been recent development, relatively recent development in the current administration of Ms. Dilma Rousseff, who succeeded Mr. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva as president in the year 2011. Mr. da Silva had held the position for the past 10 years, from January 2002 to 2011, and Ms. Rousseff has held a position in office since
2011,
and she was voted in 2010 and voted a second time in 2014. And what we find today is that because of a number of forces, she is being ousted from her position, and we wanted to discuss with Ms. Mendonca the conditions that led up to the current scandal in the Brazilian government, all of this taking place while people are watching the Olympics. Ms. Mendonca, I wanted just to start with a bit of the background of Ms. Dilma Rousseff and what she has done for the country since she took power as head of state.
Yes, President Dilma was elected and then recently re-elected in 2014. And she was implementing anti-poverty programs to deal with the a structural problem of inequality in the country. And she was investing in education, housing, healthcare. And now what we see is that she's facing impeachment process in Congress that started in the lower house by the most corrupt politicians in the country. Over 60% of Brazilian Congress members are facing serious corruption charges, and Dilma herself is not being accused of any crimes, of any corruption. So it's clear that we are facing a parliamentary coup against her for two reasons, two main reasons. One is to stop investigations of corruption, because she gave more autonomy to the federal police to investigate corruption. And the second reason is to implement austerity measures, cuts in social programs, and an agenda that was rejected by voters. Since 2002, right-wing parties are not able to win presidential elections in Brazil. So the only way for them to take power is to orchestrate this parliamentary coup. So this is basically what she's facing now.
From my understanding of the background and that was used to attempt to remove her, I understand that there was a scandal within the Brazilian national oil company Petrobras, which was given the name Car Wash. Can you please describe that for us?
Yes, there have been investigations that President Dilma actually promoted those investigations because she wants to know everything that is happening in terms of corruption cases in the country. But these types of bribes, this has been happening since the 90s, a long time ago, many decades ago, before the Workers' Party took power. And that's part of any political system. When you have, when you don't have finance reform in elections, and you have power of large companies, corporations, making bribes and contributions to politicians during campaigns. So mainly this is what is happening now. We see several prominent politicians in Brazil implicated in cases of corruption. The interim president, Michel Temer, cannot run for any office now because he is being charged with receiving illegal campaign contributions. And just a few days ago, there was a release of documents showing that the interim Minister of Foreign Relations is also implicated in receiving millions of dollars in bribes. And this is someone that just met with John Kerry when he went to Brazil for the opening of the Olympics. So it's very important that people here in the United States understand that people taking power in Brazil now, right-wing politicians, conservative politicians, they're all implicated in corruption. And the accusations against Dilma are very weak. They are accusing her of manipulating the federal budget in order to pay for social programs and delaying some payments to public banks to subsidize interest rates to provide loans for low-income housing, for instance. So this is a very weak accusation because all the previous administrations have done the same thing. It's very common that governments issue debt in order to pay for social programs. This happens here in the United States. And if the same criteria were applied now, at least 16 state governors in Brazil would have to be impeached. So this is just a plot, you know, to get rid of a president that was actually investigating cases of corruption.
As part of the trials that have taken place with the goal of removing President Dilma from office, there were leaked tape conversations between officials that revealed that much of their motivation behind getting rid of her was grounded in their own implications in this process, in this scandal with the Petrobras oil company. Can you please speak about those leaked excerpts?
Yes, exactly. There were those transcripts of phone conversations that revealed that there was actually a plot, a conspiracy against her that involved some of the interim ministers. Three of them were forced to step down just in the last few months. And it's clear that the current interim president and also even members of the Supreme Court in Brazil might be implicated in this conspiracy against President Dilma.
I wanted to discuss some of the factors. I think you alluded to a few of them already. But what are some of the factors that created this sort of vulnerability in her government that could be exploited by her political enemies? I want to perhaps look at the role of the media. I believe it's called the Globo Media Consortium, and the economics of some of her trading partners in Brazil that might have perhaps led to the need for these austerity measures. Can you please speak about the role of the media in shaping public opinion towards her?
Yes, that has a very huge impact in public opinion. So just to give you an idea, the protests against the government, at the beginning, the narrative seems very simple, as if, you know, the government was corrupt and people were on the streets protesting against corruption. But now we know that there is no accusation of corruption against President Dilma. And the protests were called by the main television networks. Imagine if you only had Fox News in the United States. This is how the media, the mainstream media, is in Brazil. So they were calling, the TV stations were calling for demonstrations against the government and then broadcasting those demonstrations live all day long. So there was a lot of manipulation of public opinion. And so that's, again, is to be able to implement austerity measures and a conservative agenda that will cut investments in healthcare, education, job creation, and also undermine labor laws, current labor laws that the conservative members of Congress and the interim president are already announcing that they would abolish several protections for workers and also rights to pension receivers, retirement plans, those kinds of things. So what we are going to see if this impeachment process goes forward is a much more conservative government that would increase inequality, social and economic inequality.
And in terms of her need to institute austerity measures that were rejected by the voters, what led up to that?
Yes, we had a situation of change in the international context that created an economic crisis in Brazil, and the amount of investment in infrastructure, education, healthcare, housing, was not able to prevent the economic crisis, which is an international crisis. Basically, there was a situation of speculation in the country. So President Dilma started to implement austerity measures to try to please financial markets, increasing interest rates and announcing cuts in governmental spending. So, but even though she was trying to please financial markets and implementing a more conservative agenda, still that was not enough to please the conservative sectors of the Brazilian society. So they are moving forward with the impeachment process.
My question now then is, with the interim president's intentions of undoing many of these programs that promote social development, from a perspective of the social determinants of health, what will the repercussions be for a population that has known significant growth within the last 12 years in the areas of public education, access to health care, improved access to housing? How will that affect their human rights in that regard?
Yes, that will have a huge impact, because still we have a situation of great inequality in the country, and the cutting social programs, cutting investments in public education and health care, that will make the situation even worse. So it's important to understand that Brazil was trying to create a different type of foreign relations policy, also trying to create stronger alliances with other countries in the global south, like the group BRICS, which involves Brazil, South Africa, China, India. It was an example of trying to build different types of partners, international partners. But, you know, we also had good relations with the United States. Dilma herself visited the United States, and that's why we are asking the Obama administration to make a clear statement in of concern about the threat to democracy in Brazil. There was just a statement released by Bernie Sanders a few days ago calling the United States government to condemn the impeachment process in Brazil because it's a threat to democracy for the whole region. Also, 43 Congress members from the Democratic process, the Democratic Party here in the United States, sent a letter to John Kerry also asking him not to support the interim government in Brazil. So hopefully we will have more visibility to this issue and also more international solidarity.
And I understand that there exists a congressional letter to Secretary of State Kerry that requests such support. And could you let the audience know exactly where they can sign on to that letter?
Yes, you can look at a website called Just Foreign Policy, and you will find information. It would be important if you thank your Congress members if they participated in this initiative in support of democracy in Brazil. And you can also find information at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C.
And lastly, how can the audience follow your work at your Institute for Social Justice and Human Rights?
Yes, our website is easy, just social.org.br for Brazil.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us on Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight.
That was a terrific interview, Paulette. Very, very, very astute and informative. Thank you.
Thank you.
And so you wanted to comment, Matt?
Yes, this interview brings to mind an old Brazilian movie about a young boy who was the lead character of many impoverished children that are just living in the streets. The name of the movie is Pixote, P-I-X-O-T-E, Pixote. And it shows the life of this boy. And as I understand it, this was a real gang member. Now they can do all kinds of crimes and get away with it and because they're under 18. Even kill somebody. They will not be prosecuted. At least this is back in the 70s, whenever this movie was made. So it shows how these people, how these young children, they band together. This is how they survive. And it's a very interesting social commentary on one particular segment of the population, Brazil.
Well, I see the correlation between what's happening all over the globe, really, and even certainly what's happening with corruption in our own country. But it's a real tragedy that this woman is doing all this good work for the people of her country, and the elite are conspiring against her. And, of course, the media is part of that conspiracy against her. So it makes me wonder how, and that they're doing it under the cover of Olympics is even more horrifying. It'll be interesting to see how it all evolves and whether or not the people really do put up with it.
Well, I think that this has been going on for quite a few months now. I mean, I first heard about this in March when they were constantly trying to come up with reasons to get rid of her. And each time that it went to court or it was put before some of their legislative branch
officers, they would say, well, you know, whatever they're accusing her of wasn't a crime. And so it's never been an issue of her doing anything that would normally get anyone fired. In fact, previous administrations did exactly the same thing that she was accused of, and nothing happened. So that it's been kind of a dance to see if they could wear her down. And so with corrupted judges who have openly come out against her and are making decisions about her future, she's having to basically struggle, and she keeps uncovering these little nuggets where, for instance, those leaked conversations, mm-hmm. that was actually released from a former executive from the oil company, Petrobras. And he released it in exchange for, I guess, a lighter sentence or something like that. But they're bent on getting rid of her, even if it's based on nothing whatsoever. And those conversations, as you heard in the interview, reveal that Rousseff had empowered the federal police to prosecute people for white-collar crime. And all of the people who are involved in this, in the Senate, are those people who are being investigated. So those conversations reveal that they were ganging up on her in revenge for basically finding them out. Mm. And so this has all been about them getting rid of her so that they themselves will escape corruption charges.
Wow. Deep situation. Well, thank you so much. I think that was very, very helpful for people. And certainly, I hope things work out for the best for her and for the people of Brazil, obviously.
I mean, they've made amazing strides within the last 12 years. It was 10 years of rule by Lula da Silva. And mm-hmm. what he did was he managed to bring a significant percentage of the population out of extreme poverty, and he moved quite a number of families into the middle class. And so he had a very organized system that was really focusing on social development, and they managed to bring around a lot of the regional economic groupings mm-hmm. to focus on social development in addition to economic development. And so now this interim administration, which might become permanent, is quickly seeking to undo everything that was done.
Mm. Sounds familiar. Well, thank you.
Welcome. You're welcome.
And so now we're going to move on to Ishmael. And I'm sure that this book will be a commentary on what we just heard. There's a real relationship here, I think. So, Matt, why don't you update us a little bit about the book itself for people who are just tuning in, and then introduce the piece that you will be reading for us.
Very good. Well, this the story Ishmael is a book about a young man who answers an ad that requests someone has a sincere desire to change the world. And when he reports to the location, he sees an enclosure. And in this enclosure is a gorilla. So the person he's going to work with actually is a gorilla, and they sort of have like a telepathic dialogue. And as the dialogue progresses, Ishmael, the gorilla, asks the student, "What's my subject?" He says, "Well, I don't know." He says, "Oh, I teach captivity." And he goes on to say, "One can't free oneself because he can't find the bars to the cage." A very interesting concept. So we continue along this vein, the subject of captivity. Ishmael's eyes closed gently in an indulgent smile. belief is not required. Once you know the story, you'll hear it everywhere in your culture, and you'll be astonished that the people around you don't hear it as well, but merely take it in. Yesterday, you told me you have the impression of being a captive. You have this impression because there is enormous pressure on you to take place in the story your culture is enacting in the world, any place at all. This pressure is exerted in all sorts of ways, on all sorts of levels, but it's exerted most basically this way. Those who refuse to take a place do not get fed. Yes, that's so. A German who couldn't bring himself to take a place in Hitler's story had an option. He could leave Germany. You don't have that option. Anywhere you go in the world, you'll find the same story being enacted, and if you don't take a place in it, you won't get fed. True. Mother Culture teaches you that this is as it should be. Except for a few thousand savages scattered here and there, all the peoples of the earth are now enacting this story. This is the story man was born to enact, and to depart from it is to resign from the human race itself, is to venture into oblivion. Your place is here, participating in the story, putting your shoulder to the wheel, and as a reward, being fed. There is no something else. To step out of the story is to fall off the edge of the world. There's no way out of it except through death. Yes, that's the way it seems. Ishmael paused to think for a bit. All this is just a preface to our work. I wanted you to hear it because I wanted you to have at least a vague idea of what you're getting into here. Once you've learned to discern the voice of Mother Culture humming in the background, telling her story over and over again to the people of your culture, you'll never stop being conscious of it. Wherever you go for the rest of your life, you'll be tempted to say to the people around you, "How can you listen to this stuff and not recognize it for what it is?" And if you do this, people will look at you oddly and wonder what the devil you're talking about. In other words, if you take this educational journey with me, you're going to find yourself alienated from the people around you, friends, family, past associates, and so on. "That I could stand," I told him, and let it go at that. "It is my most heartfelt and unattainable fantasy to travel once in your world as you do, freely and unobtrusively, to step out onto a street and flag down a taxi to take me to the airport, where I would board a flight to New York or London or Florence. Much of this fantasy is spent making delicious preparations for the journey, in pondering what must accompany me in my luggage and what may be safely left behind. You understand that I would, of course, be traveling in human disguise. If I take too much, dragging it from place to place will be tiresome. On the other hand, if I take too little, I will forever be having to break my journey to pick up things along the way, and that will be even more tiresome." "True," I said, just to be agreeable. "That's what today is for. We're packing a bag for our journey together. I'm going to throw into this bag some things I won't want to stop and pick up later on. These things will mean little or nothing to you right now. I'll just show them to you briefly, and then toss them into the bag. That way you'll recognize them when I take them out later on. Okay. First, some vocabulary. Let's have some names so we don't have to go on talking about the people of your culture and the people of all other cultures. I've used various names with various pupils, but I'm going to try a new pair with you. You're familiar with the expression, take it or leave it. Using them in this sense, do the words takers and leavers have any connotation for you? I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, if I call one group takers and the other group leavers, will this sound like I'm setting you up, one to be a good guys and the other to be bad guys? No, they sound pretty neutral to me. Good. So henceforth, I'm going to call the people of your culture takers, and the people of all other cultures leavers. I am for a bit. I have a problem with that. Speak. I don't see how you can lump everyone else in the world into one category like that. This is the way it's done in your culture, except that you use a pair of heavily loaded terms instead of these relatively neutral terms. You call yourselves civilized and all the rest primitive. You are universally agreed on these terms. I mean that the people of London and Paris and Baghdad and Seoul and Detroit and Buenos Aires and Toronto all know that, whatever else separates them, they are united in being civilized and distinct from Stone Age peoples scattered all over the world. You consider or recognize that whatever their differences, these Stone Age peoples are likewise united in being primitive. Yes, that's right. Would you be more comfortable if we used these terms, civilized and primitive? Yes, I suppose I would be, but only because I'm used to them. Takers and leavers is fine with me. Second, the map. I have it. You don't have to memorize the route. In other words, don't worry if at the end of any day you suddenly realize that you can't remember a word I've said. That doesn't matter. It's the journey itself that's going to change you. Do you see what I mean? I'm not sure. Ishmael thought for a moment. I'll give you a general idea of where we're heading. Then you'll understand. Okay. Mother culture, whose voice has been in your ear since the day of your birth, has given you an explanation of how things came to be this way. You know it well. Everyone in your culture knows it well. But this expression wasn't given to you all at once. No one ever sat you down and said, here's how things came to be this way, beginning 10 or 15 billion years ago, right up to the present. Rather, you assembled this explanation like a mosaic from a million bits of information presented to you in various ways by others who share that explanation. You assembled it from the table talk of your parents, from cartoons you watched on television, from Sunday school lessons, from your textbooks and teachers, from news broadcasts, from movies, from novels, sermons, plays, newspapers, and all the rest. Are you with me so far? I think so. This explanation of how things came to be this way is ambient in your culture. Everyone knows it, and everyone accepts it without question. Okay. As we make our journey here, we're going to be re-examining key pieces of that mosaic. We're going to be taking them out of your mosaic and fitting them into an entirely different mosaic, into an entirely different explanation of how things came to be this way. Okay. And when we're finished, you'll have an entirely new perception of the world and of all that's happened here. And it won't matter in the least whether you remember how the perception was assembled. The journey itself is going to change you, so you don't have to worry about memorizing the route we took to accomplish the change. Right, I see what you mean now. Third, he said, definitions. There are words that will have a special meaning in our discourse here. First definition, story. A story is a scenario interrelating man, the world, and the gods. A story is a scenario interrelating man, the world, and the gods. Okay? Second definition, to enact. To enact a story is to live so as to make the story a reality. In other words, to enact a story is to strive to make it come true. You recognize that this is what the people of Germany were doing under Hitler. They were trying to make the thousand-year Reich a reality. They were trying to make the story he was telling them true. Right. Third definition, culture. A culture is a people enacting a story. A people enacting a story. And a story again is a scenario interrelating man, the world, and the gods. Okay, so you're saying that the people of my culture are enacting their own story about man, the worlds, and the gods. That's right. But I still don't know what the story is. You will. Don't fret about it. For the moment, all you have to know is the two fundamentally different stories have been enacted here during the lifetime of man. One began to be enacted here some 2 or 3 million years ago by the people we've agreed to call levers, and is still being enacted by them today as successfully as ever. The other story began to be enacted here some 10 or 12 thousand years ago by the people we've agreed to call the takers, and is apparently about to end in catastrophe. Ah, I said, meaning, I know not what. If Mother Culture were to give an account of human history using these terms, it would go something like this. The levers were chapter one of human history, a long and uneventful chapter. The chapter of human history ended about 10,000 years ago with the birth of agriculture in the Near East. The event marked the beginning of chapter two, the chapter of the takers. It's true that there are still leavers living in the world, but these are anachronisms. Fossils, people living in the past, people who just don't realize that their chapter of human history is over. Right. This is the general shape of human history as it's perceived in your culture. I would say so. As you'll come to see, what I'm saying is quite different from this. The leavers are not chapter one of a story in which the takers are chapter two. Say that again? I'll say it differently. The leavers and the takers are enacting two separate stories based on entirely different and contradictory premises. This is something we'll be looking at later, so you don't have to understand it right this second. Okay.
Fascinating, fascinating. The more I hear, the more interesting it is. Thanks, Matt.
You're very welcome.
So tell people again about the book, the name, and where they can get more information. There's a website you've been giving.
The website is ishmael.org, and the author is Daniel Quinn. And he's quite an interesting, there's quite a bit of stuff on him. You know, on the net. Now, ishmael.org, and you can contact other readers of Ishmael at ishmael.com.
Okay, so there's a whole Ishmael community. Who knew? Interesting, interesting. What do you think, Paulette?
It's powerful, and it's universal.
Yeah.
It's messaging.
Yeah, I really like the part about the mosaic.
Yes.
You know, how, because that really is how people get their ideas of reality. All these little pieces come together to reinforce an ideology of some kind.
Well, these pieces of the mosaic go up to make the matrix.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very, very interesting, the idea of, also, when you discover the truth, what it is, and you start to ask people, look, don't you see what, the concept that you're going to be alienated from them. They won't want to hear it.
Well, that's been my experience, most certainly, on so many different levels. People don't want to know the truth. And they don't want to have their comfort level challenged. And I think that's why things are crashing, because people want to ignore the truth until it is lapping at their shore. And when they lose their job or their company closes or something happens close to home, then people look up and say, what's going on? But had we been able to see more a little bit while ago, things could be different. So it'll be interesting. I'm very curious. And what was it, that culture? It's man, religion, and
the gods.
The gods. Man, religion, and the gods.
The story is something that integrates man, the gods, man, I think it's nature, I think. Let's see. Let's go back a moment.
Do you remember what it was? I don't remember. Yeah. Man, the gods.
A scenario interrelating man, the world, and the gods.
Man, the world, and the gods. Okay. It's so interesting. It's very fascinating. It's the way it's pulling apart assumptions.
Well, you know what this reminds me of? Reminds me of a Castaneda. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the elements, wind, air, and fire, earth.
Yeah.
But also, Castaneda. I read all 11 of his books.
Oh, my.
Which are fascinating. And what happens is this Don Juan character takes Castaneda on these sojourns. He's feeding him various and sundry plants and mushrooms to induce these states. And he has to take him to these remote areas of the Mexican desert or jungle. And Castaneda does a good job of reporting it. And those that are interested read the books. But I'm sure with a lot of people, they think it was bull bleep.
I think a lot of people do, but I think a lot of people believe that it's very possible. I think the books may or may not be fiction, but there is a certain reality that you can get to through certain transcendental states. And I think this is where the bars, for me, the bars that I see on the cage are this limitation into the reality that we can only see with our eyes. And I believe and I feel confident that reality goes far beyond what we can see with our eyes.
Oh, definitely.
And so to me, that is one of the most fundamental bars on the cage that people experience. So, and the Castaneda books are, they really take you to another level of comprehension.
Well, this is true stuff. This is not fictional at all, Castaneda. I mean, these were, Castaneda was an anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
And this was field work for him.
Yeah.
And yes, you know, you can't just introduce this on a large scale.
Well, I don't think that everybody would be prepared for that kind of journey. And, you know, I remember when drugs became very prevalent in American society in the 60s and 50s, 60s and 70s, and people were taking LSD and other kinds of drugs that were mind-bending. A lot of those people never recovered because they were not prepared for what it provided for them. But yet, even now, there are a lot of communities that are doing that, even in this country. I think in certain states, they've legalized ayahuasca, which is a herbal remedy that is part of a religious practice, and people go into altered states. I haven't tried it, but I've spoken to people who use it or who have had gone into South America and used some of these mind-altering drugs. And really what it basically does is it strips away the veil that we have between our reality and other realities. And you can see things more from the perspective of, what's the word? Not templates, but, you know, sort of the... well, if I think of the word, I'll say it. But it's like you'll see things at their much more basic level. So you might see a goddess. You might see a talking snake. You might see, you know, different symbols that are how communication is executed in other realms of reality. So there's a lot of reality. You know, the Aboriginal people, like the Australian Aboriginal people, they talk about dream time, and that state, that dream state is the state that creates our reality.
A very good movie, speaking of Australian dream time, is The Last Wave. Mm. And that was starring our very own Richard Chamberlain, Dr. Kildare.
You're dating yourself, Matt.
This is true.
I'm dating myself because I know what you're talking about.
Well, maybe I'll date you next time.
Well, I'm dated. But really, and I think this is why a lot of people also go into meditation, transcendental meditation, because there's a reality to this. Our medical science used to scoff at it, but now it's become very recognized that it's the thoughts in our mind that have a lot to do with how well we're doing in our body and how we're doing in reality. So if you are negative, there's a very good chance that you're going to be creating negative experiences in the world. And if you have a sunnier disposition, it's much more likely you're going to have positive experiences in the world. And I took a course with Sergio Magana, who is a Toltec lineage holder, and he does a lot of ceremonies about programming your dreams. And a lot of people who do lucid dreaming talk about programming their dreams, because it's in the dream state that you can actually impact your consciousness. It's the subconscious, really. And adversely, this is how advertising works, and this is how the Matrix works, the media works. It gives you a lot of subtle programming that you don't see in your waking state, and it passes through into your subconscious state and then begins to control your behavior. It's how fear is implanted into your mind. You know, it's how they convinced the American population that they need to buy new things. It makes people feel insecure. You know, you need deodorant, you need toothpaste, you need hair pomade, you need the right clothes, you need the right shoes and the right sneakers and the right job and the right body. So people walk around feeling wholly inadequate, largely due to the programming implanted into the subconscious by advertising. I studied advertising in college, and it's highly subliminal, very subliminal, and it's meant to program people's minds. And that's what the media does as well. So when you look at what Carlos Castaneda did, or when you go into one of these traditions of the leavers, the people who are more indigenous and aboriginal to the planet, they have a lot of technology that is much more advanced than what we would see in advanced science. Really interestingly, I saw a video. I don't think I have time to find it and play it, but if I can, I will. But it's about AI, artificial intelligence, and how there's this company in Canada who's come up with a supercomputer that is capable of taking information from multidimensional existences.
Oh, this is a quantum computer.
A quantum computer, yeah.
The D-Wave.
And so they have little chips. And so it's based on this quantum theory that everything can exist in different realities at the same time. So they've created computers that can actually access parallel realities, gather information from those parallel realities, and have that information accessible here, which is fascinating because it actually works, according to them. They're spending trillions of dollars on these computers, and NASA has one of these computers because they want to actually be able to travel through space in this way. And a lot of people theorize that this is how spacecraft get here. They don't really travel through the distance. They just jump from one reality to another. And so I happen to think that this is the case. But I don't think we have to depend on a multi-million dollar computer to be able to do that. I believe that this is a natural human capacity, that we can jump realities, or that we can perceive other realities. Like the people in your story, these are not audible conversations. These are conversations of being able to integrate or read each other's minds or speak through, you know, thought projection, which is very possible even now. People can do this. So I think that quantum jumping is a little bit like that, where you can get into contact with yourself in another reality, or you can get into contact with yourself in another lifetime. So for instance, for those people who can integrate and grasp the concept of reincarnation. So reincarnation from the perspective of the soul level is simultaneous. Reincarnation from the perspective of the lived level feels like time. But from the experience of your higher soul, could look it down and see, okay, in 2016 Earth reality, I'm Paulette. But in the 18th century, I might be Bob. Or in the, you know, 5th century, I might be Elijah. You know, so from our perspective, it looks like it comes happening through time. From the soul perspective, it's simultaneous. So if we can get our level of awareness, perception, to the level of the soul, then that means that we can communicate with any of those lifetimes in real time. It's interesting.
Well, there was a particular TV program.
I've actually done that. That's how I've experimented, and I've communicated with other selves in other lifetimes. It's interesting.
Wow. It reminds me of a particular TV program a number of years ago that dealt with things like that. And it's
The Twilight Zone?
No.
I'm sure that's what people at home are saying, woo-woo, this conversation. But no, it's true.
No, in this one incident, it was in an operating room. Guy was being operated on. And when he came to, a doctor was looking for his pen. And the patient said, "Oh, I saw it while you were working on me. It's under the sun." The doctor looks, and sure enough, there it is. So he actually had a perception, you know, while his body was out.
Yeah.
That frequently happens. These are... Raymond Moody, he's a psychiatrist that specializes in stuff like this.
Yeah, that's like they talk about the near-death experience when people leave their body and can see what's happening. But you could do, I mean, if you really begin to explore this part of reality, this is something everyone does all the time. It's just that we don't remember it because it's happening at night. Usually when we're sleeping, the body's asleep. Your local mind is asleep, and your etheric self can leave your body and have other experiences and then comes back when you wake up.
Well, some people might mistake an activity, being out, going someplace, might mistake it, just think it's a dream. But it's actually another state.
Yeah. I mean, there is a dream state in between, though, because usually when you're going out into this other experience, you come back into the dream state, which is kind of interesting. I've had some of these experiences, and it made me realize that the mind is basically on autopilot. It's on autopilot. So it will continue to run, even though you're not here, to run it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like a chicken, you know, they cut off the chicken's head, it keeps running. That's how that's how our brain works. It just keeps running. I had an experience where I was in an altered state, and I was speaking to, I would presume it's like the higher self, a council that we have that's part of our existence. And I was having this conversation, and I was getting some counsel on how to go about engaging in certain ways to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish in the world or in a particular situation. And I remember as I was waking up, I maintained the consciousness of that space and conversation. And then in the background, I could hear my thoughts. And so I was aware of both levels of consciousness at the same time. And in my thoughts was this programming running, worry programs, worrying about this, you know, this is going to happen, that might happen, what am I going to do about this, what am I going to do about that? And I could feel myself gradually losing grip on that level of heightened awareness, and falling is sort of getting lost into the thoughts that my mind was already running. And then, but I was able to sort of grasp, sort of hold on a little bit to that memory, even though I didn't have the specifics of it. As I moved back into the consciousness of my body, I was aware that these thoughts were going, but they weren't actually mine. I mean, they weren't generated by my awareness, my higher awareness. And so I, for a moment, I was listening to the thoughts. I'm like, wow. And then I said, well, what are these thoughts doing to me? And I began to perceive into my body, and I could feel that the thoughts were creating tension in my body, were causing me to like have an upset stomach, and my shoulders were hurting, and all of this tension was being created in my body based on these thoughts that were just programmed thoughts. They weren't actually mine. And we all have that. And so sometimes that's why it's really a good idea, even if you're not into these mind-expanding experiences, to really pay attention to what we're thinking. You know, what's running? Because usually something is running, and it's a program. And we've been programmed by this mosaic that this book is talking about. All these little inputs that tell us to be insecure, that tell us we're too ugly or too fat or too dark or too light or too stupid. You know, all the programs that we get, they run as patterns in our mind. And then they control how we feel. They control our health. They control our behaviors. And it's these patterns that make up the matrix. And it's inserted into a level of our mind that cuts us off from our higher intelligence, our higher awareness, that we can break, that a lot of people use the drugs to get into, but it doesn't require drugs. You can do it with meditation.
Right, that would be true, yes. Mm-hmm. But in the, getting back to the Castaneda thing, Don Juan has developed, I don't know how you would describe, developed his chi so that when Castaneda nearly went off the deep end a couple of times, Don Juan, this Yaki Yeni, could actually go psychically and just bring him back. You know, he was developed. He was able to assume that responsibility. You know, if you're counseling someone like that, a shaman, he has to be able to assume that level of responsibility, because you could take the ayahuasca and you go off.
That's why it's not advisable to do things like that without a shaman who's experienced in doing that. And a lot of people do get into trouble because people who are not really qualified sometimes offer it, because it's an economy. So you really should get referrals of anyone who's going to do that, because you could get into some difficulty. Because what you're seeing is very real and very visceral, and your experience is very real and very visceral. And so if you don't have the psychological foundation to handle it, it really can throw one off the deep end, and they may not be able to recover very well. But this is also a part of just regular energy healing, spiritual healing. It you journey with people into that part of their mind where they're closed off from the thing that's causing them harm. So if a person might have been traumatized at the age of 4 or 5, they may not even remember the trauma, but it's still running their life. So that's what spiritual healing is. It's going in, journeying with the person into that part of their mind to reconcile that issue, resolve it, and release it energetically. It's a very interesting process. But, you know, you don't do that with drugs. You do that with energy and with dialogue. It's interesting. It's an interesting to connect with that level of reality, but that's really what causes most of the suffering in the world. It's that stuff that's hidden from us. It's in us, but it's hidden. Anyway, we're just about out of time. I wanted to remind people, if you want to do, join us for our Saturday in the Bronx. We're doing a meditation, Qigong meditation class, followed by a movement exercise workout class. Will there be a chef this time? And also a healthy chef will be there. So the meditation class is at 10 a.m. Then at 11 a.m. will be the chef and talking about dietary changes that you can make. And then at 11:30 is Nanamdi Nelson, who's going to be teaching movement and doing a workout routine. So it's a Saturday morning of health, and you're welcome to join us. It's absolutely free, and it's in the Bronx at Poe Park.
That is interesting. It's going to be outdoors?
It's outdoors in Poe Park. And let me see if I can... It's, where is Poe Park? I think I have it here somewhere.
On the Grand Concourse?
It's on the Grand Concourse on East 192nd Street and East Kingsbridge Road in the Bronx. So you could take the D train, would be closest, if it's running. Or you could take the 4 train, if it's running. And hopefully one or the other will get you there. Or you can take a bus. And if you're in the neighborhood, most definitely come by. It's absolutely free. It's part of the program of, what is it, Bronx Champs, Bronx Reach Champs. And so it's all about bringing people in the community to have access to healthy living, healthy lifestyles, and things that can help change and enhance life. So we hope you can join us. I'll be doing the Qigong meditation, breathing, gentle movement, and which is always very relaxing and enjoyable. And it'll be a nice morning, a nice workout. And from 10 a.m. until 12:30, I guess it'll be, and you'll be done. You would have done yourself a great service for the week. I invite you to join us. And the Heart of Mind Spiritual Support Group, the next one is in September. It's the third Wednesday of the month, so it will be the 21st of September. I invite you to join for that, and there'll be, I believe, more things going on in the Bronx, so you can join us for that as well. We want to thank you for joining us. Coming up is Jim Freund, Hour of the Wolf. Let me play a little bit of music for you. And I want to thank all of you for joining me today. And anyone want to say so long? Well, we can't. We're out of time. Come in, Jim. Get set up. I'm going to play a little bit of Amazing Grace for you, because that's kind of how I'm feeling at the moment.
Said it was blind, oh, but now Of beauty appears in every step, every sunrise, every ray of sunlight that kisses my skin. The face of beauty appears in every step, every sunrise, every ray of sunlight that kisses my skin.
Each moment's a discovery, a million ways. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly radio program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning we start out with Dan Persson's review of Kubo and the Two Strings, and I'm going to have words about that. And we're going to discuss Hugo Awards, and I'm going to do what they call Kvel. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persson's movie reviewer. I'm Dan Persson's movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Is it fair for a critic to retcon his experience of a film after he's seen the film? I ask because I'm having a kind of a crisis of conscience with Kubo and the Two Strings. Not that I didn't like the film. In fact, I love the film. It's a great animated film. It's probably the best animated film this year. It may well be the best film this year. It's a gorgeously mounted stop-motion adventure of a young boy living in a medieval fantasy Japan who goes on a mystical journey to find his missing father's armor, the only way that he can protect himself from his grandfather, the Moon King, who wishes to steal Kubo's one remaining eye. Practically everything in the film captivates, from the way Kubo uses his shamisen, a three-stringed musical instrument, to coax life into origami figures, to the tender interaction between Kubo and his mother, who was traumatized into a semi-comatose state after rescuing her son from his grandfather, to the eerie manifestation of his aunts, who serve as the deadly minions of the Moon King, to the humor and depth of emotion between Kubo and his two traveling companions, the stern, sardonic monkey, voiced by Charlize Theron, and the addled but stalwart Beetle, a cursed ninja, voiced by Matthew McConaughey. And I respect director Travis Knight's willingness to incorporate a genuine sense of loss into the drama and not chicken out by cheating it back later on. This is the fourth film out of Oregon stop-motion studio Laika, who did Coraline and Paranorman, among others, and it may well be their best. But there was a problem I had, and I don't think it was a small problem. Came during the third act, when there are revelations about who Monkey and Beetle actually are, and how they impact Kubo and his adventures. And something didn't sit right about those revelations for me, about the way they were unveiled, and how the film handled the events subsequent. And this is again a time when I wish I could say to you, stop here and come back to this review after you've seen the film, but I don't think my host would appreciate that, so I'll have to settle for vagueness in my descriptions here. The upshot is that I was conflicted through the film's third act, still loving it, but concerned about a rather prominent, for me, flaw in the narrative. And it was after leaving the film, on the subway heading back home, that I had a thought. One of the running themes of Kubo and the Two Strings is that Kubo makes his living as a storyteller at his village's market, but a storyteller who can never finish his tales. He uses his shamisen to coax origami figures representing his father and various monsters into battle, but always bolts from the tale and the disappointed audience with a cursory "to be continued." Kubo and the Two Strings is supposed to be about a boy finally writing the end to a story, his own story. When I was watching the film, my presumption was that it all took place in one reality, from beginning to end. But what if that wasn't the case? What if Kubo and his adventures with Monkey and Beetle took place in another, more mythic and fantastic reality, a storyteller's reality? There are visual cues in the film that might be suggestions of Kubo entering and leaving this reality, and looking at it that way, the third act revelations, functioning as elements of a storyteller weaving his tale before a rapt audience, work, at least for me. So, I wasn't sure what to do here. Didn't seem fair just to ignore my experience in the watching of the film. And my after-the-fact reconciliation is admittedly a bit of a stretch, me working to clear away a prominent kink in a film I otherwise dearly love. And so, I'm giving you both, and you can watch the film one way, and if that doesn't work for you, maybe you can try the other. Or come up with your own explanation. It's a free country. Because, at base, however you make your seeing of Kubo and the Two Strings work, you need to see this film, for its beautiful imagery, for its inventive action sequences, for its strangeness and its honesty of emotion. Kubo and the Two Strings, warts and all, is pure, flippin' fantastic. And just a reminder that The Scary Stuff lives on the Monster Channel, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can watch online and on your iOS device by going to monsterchannel.tv or on your Roku device by getting the Monster Channel app. And other devices are forthcoming. Stay tuned, so to speak. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
Yeah. You know, I have a wonderful little app on my browser which doesn't use the word Trump. Every time it sees the word Trump, what it does is it replaces it with the words "he who will not be named," or alternatively, it'll say Voldemort, or Tom M. Riddle, or any of the number of names that are given the bad guy in the Harry Potter series. And it does my soul good not to see that blankety-blank person's name. I don't want to see that name. I don't want to know that name. I'm better for it. My life is better for it. So... And of course, as I recommend it to people, I noticed that it was taken down. Somebody removed it. Don't know why. Don't know why. So it's not a Chrome extension anymore. So what I recommend